So, Juliet, we've just had a small break, but just to finish up the your association with this, well, your writing with the society, in 2019, continuing your interests in Lake Burley Griffin, with Anne-Chloe Long, you wrote Public Parklands Traded for Apartments, which is what you've just been talking about. What prompted you at that time to write that in 19?
I think Lake Burley Griffin and its lakeshore parklands as a unit is one of the best designed landscapes in Australia and could even be hold its own in the world as well. But I think seeing the way it's just people, the management of it has been so erratic, and it's very distressing. People trying to get bites out of the lakeshore landscape to put what they think is great there is just one little bit after another. So all of these are combining to spoil the lake.
And it's part of a very big cultural landscape, and you wrote about that again in 2020 with Anne-Chloe Long.
Well, it is a big cultural landscape, but cultural landscapes, some of them are quite big. But it's still a clearly defined unit, Lake Burley Griffin. It's the lake with its lakeshore parklands. And there's another one in China, West Lake in Hangzhou, which I know quite well. And it's an urban lake, and it has parklands around it, gardens. It has temples too close to it. But it's now on the World Heritage List. When I first saw it, it wasn't on any heritage list, but now it's gone to World Heritage as an urban designed landscape. And I think, and I did a paper on that at an early ICOMOS conference comparing these two urban landscapes, just a couple of thousand years in between them in terms of age. But, yes. They're an interesting comparison, those two lakes.
Did you invite advise at all on the Chinese?
No, I didn't advise, but I did write that paper, and I think I surprised people, the Chinese people, by writing about their lake, and a lot of people had written about the lake, Chinese people. In fact, I've got a lovely book in there that was given to me by one of the Chinese scholars, and then went into the history of the lake, which I wrote about it, but only what I could gather by seeing it and knowing it and walking. I lived there close to it when I was teaching English, so I went around the lake frequently. And it was interesting, beautiful. It was lovely. It was beautiful. It had lovely gardens and all sorts of nice aspects, a special poetry written about it and other little statues, and there was old ancient stories associated with it, and yeah, there's a lot about it, but I can't talk about it all.
No. Is there poetry written about Lake Burley Griffin?
There was something, actually. There was something that was, I don't know if it actually, I don't particularly the lake, but there was a poem written that was the Garden History Society had something to do with that, and there was a talk, and I think there was a bit of a statue made of it, and I'm sorry, but I've just forgotten who wrote it. And
no, there's a lovely clue to follow up.
Yes.
And I've momentarily forgotten about you spending time in China, living there. When was that? In your 50s? 20s?
Later. Yes, I decided to go take my long service leave, a part pay, and go there and do English, teach English. And I really enjoyed it. My students were doctors, so weren't little kids in the school, and it was a very interesting experience, and being in Hangzhou and being near the lake was wonderful. So I went back again, and that coincided with an international ICOMOS conference in Xi'an. So I was able to go there, and that's where I presented that paper on the two lakes.
And so how long did you spend living in?
Oh, it was only three months stints.
Oh. Mm. And why did you choose to teach English and not spend your time on the banks of the Seine, for example?
I don't know. I don't know. I've just always been fascinated by China and I just wanted to go there. Mm. It's a fascinating country.
Yes, of course, yes. Well, that's a time, another interview. You were going to say something, sorry.
No, I was just going to say that the landscaping work in China is pretty fantastic. Watching them build new pathways around the lake and seeing the way they construct them. Very, very well done indeed.
So the
and lovely plantings. There was a bit of a move there to reintroduce local native plants too. So Chinese native plants. Dawn cypress, I think it is, that they've planted a lot of that around the lake.
Did you have an opportunity to travel around yourself when you were there?
I did go on a trip down to, down south to one of the river place where there's those limestone mountains and went on a bit of a tour of that, but yeah. They paid for me to go on that trip and they put me in a Chinese hotel. I couldn't speak one word to anybody and I had to just try and point at food I like to eat. I had some pretty interesting experiences with food.
I can imagine. Yes. So coming to ICOMOS, mm-hmm. and what was your first encounter with ICOMOS?
Well, I went, Brian was a member. And I was interested in cultural landscapes and historic garden. And there was not a cultural landscape group, but a historic gardens group. And I became a member of that. And I was the first Australian to join that committee. And then when the conference was held in Xi'an, they were moving over to cultural landscapes then. Changed the name from historic gardens to cultural landscapes. People in the group, some of the Europeans weren't happy with this cultural landscape thing. They loved the historic gardens. They'd done wonderful studies of historic gardens in the world and they had done a very nice publication on historic gardens. I used to have a copy of that. In fact, I had two copies, but I don't have any now. But yes. So that's when I really became an official member before that Xi'an conference.
And you also presented in Mexico.
Yes, I did, but I wasn't a member of that. I was a sort of linked member, but not an official member of the committee at that stage. But I gave a paper then on the work we've been doing in the forests on cultural landscapes and how we had studied them. Yeah.
And how did you convince the other members of ICOMOS to go with the cultural landscapes title?
Well, ICOMOS has, international ICOMOS has lots of specialist areas, sort of adobe buildings, different architecture, stained glass, archaeology. They've all got subcommittees on those topics. And they write, International ICOMOS had written, I think, to various national organisations to encourage people to go on the various committees. And it seemed to be that I was one of the few that are nominated to go on the historic gardens one that became the cultural landscape committee.
But was that your idea that pushed the change for cultural landscapes?
No, I mean, cultural landscapes was moving. International ICOMOS was looking at cultural landscapes. They wanted to change, and they did, and the historic gardens people, as I said, weren't quite happy about it at first.
But they came around.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And it got a different membership too once it became cultural landscapes. There were other people coming into the group that weren't sort of from a landscape architecture background or a historic, historic landscape background.
And where did you meet?
Well, we met at these international conferences, and so that was that Xi'an one, and I'm just trying to think where else we've been. We went to Turkey. We had a meeting in Turkey, but there were always issues to discuss with the committee. So the committee would have a little symposium before the main conference and talk about our particular work and what we were trying to push. The other thing that these committees did, members of these committees did, they were asked to do reviews of World Heritage nominations on those particular topics. So, one of the areas of interest for the... Are we going on to ICOMOS now?
Yes.
One of the areas of interest for ICOMOS, well, I thought it was an area of concern, was everything had to be assessed for World Heritage according to World Heritage criteria. And they had something like 8 criterion. And there was a natural group that weren't ICOMOS, IUCN group, who assessed natural areas for World Heritage, forests and things of that nature. And then there was the cultural group, which was ICOMOS, assessed cultural places. But the criteria were divided so that the cultural people couldn't use the aesthetic criterion. That was owned by the natural people. And it was, to me, a bone of contention that we couldn't use that criterion for cultural places. Whereas in Australia, we had been using the aesthetic criterion for cultural places. And we really had formulated a process of doing this when for the forest assessments that I was involved with. I spent almost 4 years working on forest task force work, which I loved. And we had a process of dealing with aesthetics. And it's so common. People would come to... We had community meetings. People would come to the meeting and say, well, I love that place because it's beautiful. And so you had to turn around and try to make an evaluation of these comments and try to get them to be something that can stand the test of time, which was more or less a sort of almost a legal evaluation of values for heritage lists, both for the nation here, Australia, but also for World Heritage. They had to be evaluated properly. So I spent a bit of time, firstly, in the forest work with other members of staff. I remember Sue Feary of Sandy Blair was involved too. And we worked out a process for assessing the aesthetic value, which there's been an enormous amount of literature about aesthetics. It's unbelievable. All these philosophers that have written about aesthetics and trying to get a process that works. But unfortunately, the standard way that Europeans have looked at aesthetics, probably in the last 150 years, has been according to a philosopher, Baumgarten, I think his name was, and it became like a taste, whether it was at the taste of the assessor. But that's not good enough. The criteria that Australia used, the criterion for aesthetic, was valued by a community or cultural group, which put it into a different level. We had to establish how that value was appreciated through by a community group or community groups or different people. So we developed a method for doing that. But it was also looking at aesthetics itself and how you can analyse this concept of beauty and to make it more structured and to put it into a way that you can assess it. And I think with ICOMOS, I think we sort of did it for the forest, but with ICOMOS, we had people from all parts of the world in that committee. And I think we had a workshop in Turkey on aesthetics, and it was really good. I mean, people responded wonderfully. And there were people who had architects who had to assess impacts of architecture on cityscapes and so forth, and get told how they did it. But it was also getting the Islamic type understanding of aesthetics from people in Turkey and people from Iran, because we had members in our committee, and we had members from India and Indonesia, Japan, China, all with their views on aesthetics. So it was pulling together all this information for a report, which they didn't all gel, they were different, but then to try to come up with a way people can look at trying to assess this. So we did a report from the committee, and we did ended up with a kind of, well, I don't know whether anyone uses it, but I thought it was quite useful, a chart on just looking at aesthetics and the emotional reaction of aesthetics that people have. People say the wow factor, but what the evocations of first impressions, then how, what, why people have felt that way. Is it something in their background? Is it something in their religion or whatever? And then leading to what are the features that actually express the aesthetics of that place? And because it's only the features that you'll be protecting. You can't sort of protect the emotional value. And soundscapes is another part of it, to listen to the sounds. And the colours and the patterns and all those things as well. So it was quite complicated. I mean, but I thought it was quite a worthwhile thing. Yeah.
Quite a worthwhile thing. That sounds like a very modest response.
Well,
I don't think
it's gone very far. I did get it put on the website for our local ICOMOS group, National Scientific Committee on Cultural Landscapes, but I'm not sure that people have looked at it or bothered to read it or even use it.
Is that because of the complexity?
Well, I think everybody's comes to cultural landscape with their own background, and it could be Indigenous archaeology that's got them into cultural landscapes or something else. So, yeah, it's different. I think people probably doing World Heritage assessments may look at it and may look at how to assess the aesthetic value, but then again, they have to put it against not the aesthetics criterion, but one of the others. They have to kind of distort it to go against one of the other criterion. Yeah.
So the aesthetics take in so much beyond the fabric, as you say, the sounds and the emotion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And did you involve any people in the fine arts world?
Well, fine arts definitely comes in. I didn't involve them in the conversations, but a lot of the assessment methods have looked at fine arts, when we did the forest, there's a Canadian scholar who's written about it and says the natural environment should be assessed like an object of art, and it should be experts in art assess art, and experts in forests. So in a way, we used that. We used experts in the forest assessment, plus the community, plus other things like tourism guides and all sorts of things, to come on with a package of why that place had aesthetic importance. But we did use the forest experts, and they were very good. They would map out areas on their maps which they thought had high aesthetic appeal and interest. Yeah.
Very exciting work,
yes.
It must have been.
And early foresters used to actually cut off branches of trees so they could get better views and things through them.
In one of your writings, and I just can't remember for the moment which article it was, but you talked about how a presentation at a seminar series you had, a presentation by an Indigenous man was the most thrilling in one of the forest meetings that you had, and the way Indigenous people look at, maybe it was tracks, was it tracks?
Oh, it could have been tracks, yes. I did that paper with that, Marilyn Truscott.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes. And how we look at those, how Indigenous people look at the landscape from a drone.
I was going to say almost like a bird's eye view.
Yes. And big areas
of
land.
Yes, that's right. Well, The way the Heritage Commission dealt with it in those early years, when Betty Meehan was director of the Indigenous section, they did a series of very good studies using anthropologists, and they did sort of areas that were linked. So they'd have a special area probably around a waterhole, and then 10 k's or further there'd be another spot where people walked, and they became the song lines. They were all linked to the song line story. Fascinating work, and again, I don't know what's happened to it. You can't get it on the web anywhere, because they took it all out because it was someone thought it was infringing on Indigenous values. But it was an incredibly valuable work they did. So I'm sorry that's happened, but I don't know where those old studies have gone, what's happened to them.
So do people continue to consult you about aesthetics?
No.
It's a very definite. Do you wish they did?
Not really.
Do you feel it's made a difference along the way?
I think it did. I think I've seen sort of people using our methodology. So it's out there, and some people have been using it, yeah.
Are they using it for Lake Burley Griffin?
No. Mm. Yeah.
So just some of the names that might prompt some thoughts, and we don't have to comment about all of these, but you've worked with that landscape and cultural roots in the 21st century, that you, issues and opportunities, you wrote about in the Landscape Review and then co-edited with Ken Taylor. I can't get a copy.
Oh, that was, yes. We that was in 2013. We had one of the ICOMOS Cultural Landscape Symposiums in Canberra. And so we organised a series of speakers, and people put in ideas for papers, and we had lots of presentations. And Ken was on the board of Rutledge, I think. He was somehow involved with the journal that does cultural landscape. So we got a publication of all the papers that we presented. We got two publications, one through Platmob, the Rutledge on cultural landscapes, and then we had another one through ICOMOS itself, on which was more the architectural, more those aspects of the symposium. And so it was good. We had two publications from that one symposium. And it was interesting because some of the people, you know, their English not all that great, the people that come from overseas, so had to do a lot of editing of the English to make the papers work. But there was a lovely one of tea plantations in Sri Lanka, and I'm just trying to remember them all now, but there was quite a good collection, I think.
We can fill that in later.
Okay. All right.
I'm putting you on the spot here.
Yes.
So do you enjoy that collaboration?
Well, I think it worked well for that one. It worked well. I mean, it's difficult doing something that suits everybody, and people are not happy with some aspects and might get their feathers ruffled about a few things, but we did end up with two publications. I think Kirsty was co-editor of one of them.
Kirsty
Altenberg?
Don't know that name.
The one that was done by Australia ICOMOS.
Right. Then there was in 2015, you did, again, on the aesthetics, perhaps this is the guide you're speaking of, with Nancy Pollock Elwand, Adine Kremen, Jane Lennon, Brian Egloff, and Stuart Reed.
What did I write?
I've just got the title here, right. 2015. You were co-chair of the Cultural Landscapes and Cultural Roots.
Was with Sandy Blair. She and I both started that subcommittee for ICOMOS.
Right.
Because the Tracks Roots people didn't have very many members. We were beginning to get quite a lot in cultural landscapes, and so we combined them both and made the subcommittee. So it still exists now, the Cultural Landscapes and Roots Subcommittee of Australia ICOMOS.
So unlike the aesthetics, it's got a definite base and...
Yeah, the aesthetics is just one aspect for assessment.
Yes. But the cultural landscapes are not threatened or thwarted in any way. It's a definite part of the work.
Oh, yes. So there have been some big challenges for the group. They're trying at one stage to get Adelaide Parklands. There was a move there to have it a World Heritage nomination. And so I think our group, but it would have only been the cultural landscape people, not the roots people, were involved in helping out a bit with that one and giving some guidance. But I don't think it's gone anywhere. It's a very tricky one to get World Heritage nomination for.
Is that including all the vineyards in that area?
Some, a collection of the vineyards and, yeah, and some of them, and some of the towns too, some of the townscapes that were involved, old historic towns as well.
I think the Garden History Society was looking at that in the teens,
yes,
at one of the conferences there,
yes,
as well,
they probably
supporting
were.
That.
Yeah.
Then in 2017, there was the Delhi Conference.
Yeah.
And you chaired the Working Group on Advocacy.
Yes. Well, it didn't go anywhere.
Oh, dear.
I've been chaired the aesthetics for the group, and also we did a methodology for reviewing World Heritage nominations. Myself and Patricia O'Donnell did that together. And I think that's been quite useful for many people who are suddenly doing a review, that they can follow various steps to see that they've covered everything. But the advocacy I thought would be useful because I've been doing so much for Lake Billy Griffin Gardens, but I couldn't get a team that would work on it. People expressed interest when we were in New Delhi, but afterwards it didn't work. So we dropped it.
Do you have any thoughts about why it didn't work?
Well, I think people are just so overwhelmed with everything in work and daily life that something else, probably something that they didn't think they needed. Also, I do think advocacy has to be kind of grassroots. And trying to do things at a higher level, there are guides on advocacy around already, and ICOMOS itself has something, and it has a risk management group as well, so there are various other things, and I just think people just couldn't be bothered with it.
It doesn't also look terribly good on your CV always, if you're part of if you're at that point in your career. To have advocacy, you become a troublemaker or a whistleblower.
Maybe. But this was all post-work, so it didn't matter.
Whereas grassroots, that's not such a danger
or a risk. No, it's not when you've finished work, retirement.
Yes.
That's why people who retire get involved in these things when they probably normally wouldn't.
As you have done.
Yes.
So, just coming back to ICOMOS, well, continuing with ICOMOS, you were given honorary membership of ICOMOS in 2018, and with some lovely comments about your willingness to lead initiatives, your transfer of knowledge, your in-depth work on the aesthetic values and associated publications, and your persistent advocacy for Canberra's landscape heritage. How did you feel about that award?
I got a shock. When I got that award, actually, I was quite surprised. I hadn't expected it. I didn't know it was happening, and suddenly they announced it. I think there are people that are much more hardworking in ICOMOS than I am too. So I feel a bit guilty now because I'm not doing much in terms of ICOMOS work, though I did write a little report the other day for the next meeting, but of the NSC, but no, I do almost nothing for them now. It's an age thing, I think, you know.
But is the award about future work
probably not. But there are other people that do high-powered work for ICOMOS and are on the committees and, you know, do a lot of international work as well, so, yeah.
Do you enjoy your involvement with ICOMOS?
I have enjoyed it in the past enormously. I've certainly enjoyed that committee, the Cultural Landscapes Committee, and going to those, attending those wonderful symposiums in different parts of the world, in North Korea and Japan and Xi'an and Turkey. There was a meeting in Bath in England, so I managed to go there for a very quick meeting.
And it must have taken up a fair chunk of your time.
Oh, it took a bit of time, yes, and takes a bit of money too, because you don't get anyone to pay for you. The Heritage Commission would give me time, so I'd get paid time while I was attending some of those things.
So your involvement with ICOMOS overlapped when you were still working as well?
Yes.
And support from ICOMOS as well, not just the financial support, but support for your giving time to ICOMOS?
Well, ICOMOS is a pretty amazing organisation, and they do a lot of advocacy and they do it very well. They're very crystal clear on what they write, and getting, them to write an advocacy document is very worthwhile if you can, yeah.
Did you have any involvement in the Society's now done an advocacy toolkit?
Yeah.
Did you have any input
to
that?
No, I didn't really. Anne was involved in that, yes. No, I haven't been really involved in it. I wonder if I'll be interested to see feedback from people who use it, I think.
And speaking of feedback and just darting back to the Society, there's part of a conversation with the Society members about changing the name to... How do you feel about changing the name?
I didn't know that was happening. So I really can't say.
Do you think there's any purpose in changing the name from the Australian Garden? Could it be better, improved with a different name?
I don't know. I quite like the Garden History Society as a name. And I think if you go cultural landscapes, then you're in competition with ICOMOS. And
yet there's room to include that.
Well, if there's room to include it, perhaps historic gardens and landscapes or something.
But I mean in the work.
Yes.
By changing the name, does it change your work?
No.
I don't.
No. I don't know what I think about it. I think there was a long time, for a while we were called Garden Cuttings. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes, that was a contentious time, I think, with Tim North.
Yes.
That's a long time ago, gosh. And,
well, I think that's sort of soon after I joined. The journal became Garden Cuttings. And I didn't like that at all. And I don't think it suited a lot of people. But I think the Garden History Society is quite a good old established name, actually. And it's held its own for a long time now.
Indeed. So just speaking of Stuart Reid, as we were, you worked with Stuart for a time.
Yes, he came to work in the Heritage Commission, and so I worked with him there. And it's always lovely working with Stuart. He's good, fun, bright, cheery, irreverent when it needs to be.
And now he's been co-chair of the Garden History Society.
Yes, done a fantastic job, yeah.
That's a tricky...
And those are such hard... That's hard work. And the same for ICOMOS. The executive do enormous amount of work and difficult work. So, yeah. I think the Garden History Society works well for what it does. I mean, it's a national organisation. It has national conferences. I was thinking it wouldn't work if it had to link with something international either. It's just good as it is. That's my opinion anyhow.
Yes, there are many. That's perhaps another topic for a whole interview in itself, how that functions and works.
But cultural landscape could be linked in if it possible, but yes.
So some of the members and contributing advisory honorary expert, this is perhaps the Bath conference time in 16, Steve Brown, Jane Lennon.
Yep.
You worked with Rachel Jackson, Stuart, Neil Draper, Caroline Grant, who's now popped up again. I think Caroline's on the NMC
for the
Garden History Society.
Because she's in Perth, yes, that's good.
Did you work with her?
A bit. Well, yes, she's been very generous to me, and she invited me to talk at one of the symposiums they had in Perth, and she gave me hospitality there, and so, yes, she's a terrific person.
How do you feel the society, that next younger group is coming through?
Well, that's the difficulty. I don't know whether it's coming through. And I suppose if the Garden History Society is doing anything, would be to try and do something to attract the younger generation.
How do you do that?
I don't know. I really don't. And what are they interested in? They don't seem to be terribly interested in garden history. In terms of landscape, well, they all want to do their smart new modern designs. I wonder, sort of, Gardening Australia's got a huge following, but we don't have much garden history since John Patrick left. And he was very good at talking about historic gardens on the Gardening Australia.
On the television show?
Yes, on the television show. So whether they can do that a bit more productively.
Sometimes it seems a bit giddy.
Yeah, it is. You're jumping from one thing to another, one person to another, one idea to another, and they could have a little bit more on historic gardens, I think, which they don't have. They don't have any now, come to think of it.
Is that your next advocacy role?
Get Costa and give him an earful. And I think people enjoyed it. I'm sure they did. John Patrick was very good, but he would talk about places in Victoria, which has wonderful gardens. And occasionally they do go to some of those old gardens, but, yeah, I don't think people realise how wonderful they are. And they don't have to be really historic. They can be fairly modern gardens too, but they deserve to be heritage gardens. So I wonder if the historic might be putting people off. I don't know. But on one of the garden history conferences, we went to the Mornington Peninsula and saw these beautiful native gardens, just grasses. She talked about grasses, but just wonderful grasslands and native bushes and shrubs. Perfect. And we also went to Elizabeth Murdoch's place.
Oh, did you?
Yes, yeah, so it was a fantastic conference.
And was she in residence at
the
time?
She came and met everybody at the bus. She came out in her little golf buggy thing that she drives around. She stood there and she shook everyone's hands as they got off the bus. And there were about a couple of buses. Mm. She was amazing.
Mm. We're just talking about ICOMOS and the society, Juliet, and had some lovely comments.
Right. Well, I think heritage, because ICOMOS is the organisation that covers heritage in Australia, mostly, and that there's lots of work in heritage, various facets of heritage, guides in museums, guides in art galleries, working for the government, doing heritage restoration work in terms of architecture or landscape architecture or whatever. So I think younger people feel that they, if they are looking for work in that area, and also there's big government departments that cover heritage. So people, even people who are lawyers might want to do heritage, and might want to work in a heritage department. So they will try to get a bit involved and learn about it. And I think tourism too utilises heritage all the time, and it needs better management probably to get the heritage correct. And when you start talking about heritage, you have to acknowledge history because it's there and it's very important. So it brings together all those aspects of history and design and people and work and everything. So, yes, heritage is important. And I've sort of just waffled along, sort of working on the gardens and working in the department, working for the forests. And that was the Regional Forest Agreement. that ran for a number of years. I worked for 4 years on it, but it ran for longer. And it was started by an international agreement called the Montreal Agreement that set the criteria for keeping forests in countries and to stop them all being logged. So identifying key places and protecting those that are in forests. So we worked alongside our natural environment people who looked at things like powerful owl habitats and long-footed potoroos, and we were looking at people sites, the cultural heritage sites. The forests are full of everything apart from indigenous heritage, but there's gold mining sites and old settlement sites and whatever. Waterworks, everything that's sort of hidden away in forests. Defence sites, even some of them. So they're all there, and it was fascinating working. When we did that work, we also did a lot of community workshops. So we went out and I forget how many I did, I can't remember. There were so many. For every area, there were three or four. I did lots and lots of them with Indigenous people and with communities and with other professionals too helping us do them. And so we got opinions of people and why they liked them. Did they like special places? We've tried to tease out aesthetic value, whether it's history, whether it's their great uncles have been there and built that fence or whatever. So it was all really wonderful in a way.
Did they understand what you were doing?
Yes, they did, I think. Eventually, they didn't at first. And one meeting we held in Benang, which was very early on when we started the work, and people were late. They weren't coming. I thought, oh, this is terrible. They're not going to come. And then they came in, a whole group of them. They're smelling of horses and looking like they'd just stepped off horses. And we started to show slides of things that might be important, like chock and log fences and old huts. And, oh, yes, my uncle built a hut like that out there. And, oh, yeah, we got a fence like that on our property. And they got really interested. In fact, I saw some of the members later, years later, down in Bairnsdale, going to one of the local council heritage meetings. So, and they had a church in Benang that was multi-denominational, that was used by other religions. And it was a delightful church, but the fact that it had been going for years, that was its heritage importance. The fact that it was multi-denominational. Anyhow, I remember writing the statement of significance for that. And this woman wrote back and said, thank you for saying such lovely words about our little church. So, yeah, it was, people don't realise what they've got, lots of people. Or they think heritage, they have a view of heritage. And they are quite amazed that some of these special people places are important.
Yeah. Sometimes I think people know more than they think they know.
You're right, yes.
And sometimes community is seen as a great nuisance by the great and experts.
Yes, yes, yes.
Did you enjoy those community interactions?
I did. I enjoyed them all. And some of them were tough. I think we had one area in Victoria where it was a special meeting and they sent me out to run it, which I thought was unfair. Because there was a group of people who were pro-forest and not happy with the logging activity that had been going on, and they weren't happy with the Victorian State Forest Department, and that was the other group we were working with. And so they said, oh, well, you can run a special meeting in the evening for these people and see how you go. So I had to do that.
Did you feel you were being dropped in at the deep end?
I did. But I said, just write down places that you think should be saved. And they spend all evening doing that, thank goodness. But you talk about the NIMBYs. Yes, they come out. They came out for a lot of those meetings.
So when you talked about the aesthetics, the aesthetic value of forests, is that respected today?
I think people are using the methodology to a degree. We had a few good consultants working for us too, Robert Crocker and another guy. But yeah, they did some good work And they worked also for the department later. We did some aesthetic assessments of other key places, and they did a good job on those as well.
Mm. We started at the beginning of our interview, Juliet, talking about your guide, and I'd really like to just talk about those two guides, your parks, gardens and special trees, your classification and assessment, which is still in use and still valued. How do you feel about that, and what was it like at the time writing that? You spoke about
that. Oh, it was fun. I was just sort of pulling the bits together and sort of seeing the connections with places and seeing how the styles were being manifested in these gardens, and so I just sort of got the paper, you know, I just wrote it up, and and Sandy said, oh, that's good for a little technical publication, so that's what we did. I'm not sure everybody appreciated it, but we did it anyhow. Sweet. And later I did, I wrote about garden styles for our ICOMOS historic gardens people. They were asking them, they wanted every country to write about garden styles. I don't know whether they all did, but I did, for based really on the work I'd done for the commission. So I wanted to include parks, but also landscape areas in towns. You know, if you go, especially some rural towns that have a lovely area beside, it's like a park beside the river, that they're important to keep those as well. They're really heritage components of a town. And then we get into the spaces, these spaces in town that are all part of that heritage, was part of the heritage landscape of the town.
And that same year, in 91, you also wrote How to Record the National Estate Values of Gardens. You were busy in 91.
Was that... Oh, did I write a paper? It must have been one of the papers based on that guide, yeah.
Mm. They're both in the State Library in New South Wales.
Oh, good.
It's good. Yeah. In the special trees, parks and gardens, special trees, you acknowledged a number of people who are all still significant in the Garden History Society. So, Olean Richards, Howard Tanner.
Yes.
Peter Watts, Richard Aiken, Sandy Blair. Yep. So there's a long trajectory of your life interwoven with the society, or society members at least.
Yes, they were important, and especially the people that did those books. Olean Richard did the one in Western Australia, and just checking. I think it was Beams and Whitehall did the one in South Australia, Beams and Whitehill, and... And of course, they've been already been the books by Beatrice Bly and Howard Tanner for reference. Helen Armstrong, who was electric landscape at New South Wales and then Queensland, she'd done a lot of work too, so I looked at her work. Yeah, and James Broadbent, of course.
There was the... Again, perhaps this is part of your forest work. In 2002, it was the UN International Year of Mountains, and there was an ICOMOS conference in Jindabyne.
That happened because I just happened to be on through work on an Alps committee, and it was the Year of Mountains, and so I said, well, we should have a conference on that, Jindabyne, and then all the other groups got into the natural people and others. So it was a big conference, and we ran the cultural aspect. I think the Indigenous was kept separate, if I remember rightly. They did their own bit, but did they go with us? Anyhow, it was a good conference. We brought out an Indigenous person, an Inuit person, and she was fantastic. She also gave the commission a special presentation of what was happening then, and she's talking about climate change back then, and how all the ice is melting and how things are changing for the animals that live there as well. and the things I was finding under the ice too, old hats and all sorts of things. Yes.
Some of the people involved in that conference with you, you're the leader, but
Marilyn was involved.
Yes, Marilyn Truscott, Eva Logan, Alastair Grinberg.
Yes.
Adine Kremen again.
Yes.
And Sarah Jane Brassel.
That's right, yes. They're all involved in helping to get that going. Yeah.
Has there been a mountains conference since? An Alps conference?
Another one. Not that I'm aware of. but it was because it was Year of the Mountains.
Yes, yes.
And we just grabbed that opportunity.
Juliet, you've been incredibly generous today. Is there anything about your work and these committees and your involvement with ICOMOS that I have not asked you about that you want to ensure is part of this?
Not really, except I'd just like to thank all those people that have done such excellent work running these organisations, the Garden History Society and ICOMOS, because they work very hard. And yes, it would be really good if the Garden History could somehow draw young people into it, because I think it's missing out there.
Mm-hmm.
And they're missing out too. They're missing out on seeing all the beautiful gardens and getting inspired by them. And I mean, just going into a garden like Lanyon and seeing the old bunya pine, you know, it's just wonderful. It's a sense of time. And that we're losing that in our streetscapes. I just went along the road yesterday and this huge big eucalypt had been cut down.
Oh.
And it just sort of breaks my heart when I see those things. But they're such markers of time, the old trees that are in those towns. And yes.
And since your retirement, speaking of trees, you've taken up painting.
Yes.
Or has that always been an interest?
Oh, it's always been an interest, but I didn't have much time for it when I was working. And so I'm now devoting a lot more time to it, which is good.
And you've exhibited in local...
Yes, I did.
...exhibitions?
Well, yes, I curated an exhibition here in Maruya with my new art group and me, and it was good.
And what was the title of that?
Cherish Nature.
And then there was one about trees.
Oh no, that was me. My trees were in that exhibition.
Ah.
Yeah.
And most recently you showed me your snow gums that you painted.
Yes. Well, I've got a whole lot of things whooshing around in my head that I'd like to get out and paint.
Well, I think that's a lovely note to end on. So thank you very much for your contribution.
Thank you very much, Ros. And thank the Garden History Society for actually trying to get me on there in their oral history record.
We're on.
In talking about historic gardens and parks and trees, we've got to remember about spaces and how important they are in all urban areas. Just the verges, things by the rivers, where people can walk and where they can recreate. And I did write a paper with Han Feng, from China, and we did a paper called Space is Not Nothing. It's really important. It's important to have space like water to appreciate the landscape beyond, and or even just squares of space in cities are important. The places where you can view mountains beyond and those sorts of things. So, yes, when we did Space is Not Nothing paper, we based it on the aesthetics work that the ICOMOS Cultural Landscape Group had done.